Coming up, David Tereshchuk on a congregation in Brooklyn offering a cash prize to someone who can explain in plain English why America's economy is so disappointing. Also, my interview with Britain's former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, on religion and violence. And Tibetans preparing spiritually for their new year.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Prayers and remembrances were held this week for Kayla Mueller, the 26-year-old American who was confirmed dead after being held by ISIS militants for a year and a half. The White House confirmed the news of her death, but it was unclear how or when she died. Mueller was a Christian aid worker who went to Syria in 2013 because she felt called to work with the refugees there. Her family members and friends said she leaned on her Christian faith. In 2014, while in captivity, Mueller sent a letter to her family. She said, quote, "The thought of your pain is the source of my own. Simultaneously, the hope of reunion is the source of my strength. Please be patient. Give your pain to God." President Obama said he was heartbroken over Mueller's death. He also defended the U.S. government's efforts to rescue her and other Americans who have been abducted by ISIS. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, thousands gathered to mourn the deaths of three Muslim students who were shot in their apartment, allegedly by a neighbor. The suspect is 46-year-old Craig Stephen Hicks, who was arrested and charged with three counts of first-degree murder. He's a self-described gun-toting atheist who has a history of criticizing Islam on social media. Many faith groups are calling for a hate crimes investigation amid speculation that Hicks was motivated by anti-Muslim prejudice. Meanwhile, in Alabama, confusion over the legality of same-sex marriage prevailed as gay couples began marrying in some counties, but not others. This week, a federal judge's decision to overturn the state ban on gay marriage went into effect, but Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore ordered local probate judges not to issue marriage licenses, throwing the courts into confusion. While judges in some counties began issuing licenses, most did not. Many judges have refused to issue marriage licenses altogether until the conflict is sorted out. At the Vatican, Pope Francis had a full week. He met with a hand-selected group of nine cardinals about making reforms to the church's administration. Among the topics of discussion was the Vatican Bank, which has been plagued by allegations of scandal. Francis then discussed these potential reforms behind closed doors with the entire College of Cardinals. They were there to witness the formal installation of 20 new cardinals. Many of the new cardinals are from the developing world. None is from the United States. At his weekly general audience, Francis expressed concern about the 300 migrants reported to have drowned near the Italian island of Lampedusa while attempting to cross the Mediterranean from Libya. The UN said the migrants had attempted to make the dangerous journey on four open rubber boats without food or water. In recent months, refugees fleeing Iraq, Syria, and Mali have attempted similar trips that have also resulted in many deaths. Now, a local church with a national question. There's a congregation in Brooklyn that's offering a cash award to someone who can explain to the average American why the U.S. economy has become so disappointing. Jobs going overseas, technology demanding unavailable skills, a few getting too rich. David Tereshchuk reports.
Stockholm this isn't, in spite of the waterfront setting. It's Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, but it has something in common with that Scandinavian home of the Nobel Prizes. This New York City district is originating its own prize for economics, and the beginnings of that prize lie in a local church.
To me, the idea of a church offering a economic well-being award makes perfect sense.
Members of Bay Ridge United Methodist Church originally found themselves embroiled in controversy over the idea of getting involved in economic questions.
There are a lot of reservations about combining politics and church, things like economics and political parties, a lot of misgivings.
The debate had begun with the minister, Robert Emmerich, feeling bombarded by rival claims from politicians during recent election campaigns.
It seemed to me as a Christian minister that I needed to know whether the claims were true or false.
Eventually, it was agreed that the church should offer an economic well-being award with a cash amount of $33,000. The church bought a large advertisement, a half page, in the New York Times, and it invited economists individually or in teams to apply for the prize. The ad said the congregation wanted an economist's clear and convincing explanation for why our economy is in such doldrums compared with a generation ago.
We're asking for somebody to explain what are those factors, because every key economic indicator was stronger in that post-war period up to 1971, and every key economic indicator has been weaker since then.
Pastor Emmerich has no illusions that his church's award is a match for the $1 million Nobel Economics Prize, but he's convinced that it has value.
Obviously, there's a difference in the amount of money, but above all, we want it to be useful. We want to develop something that the average person can use, that you don't need a PhD in economics to understand it.
That demand for an understandable explanation is what won the day among doubtful church members. Their step into the public arena on economic matters is central to their faith, they say.
This thing that we're doing now, it's newsworthy, but I was thinking of things being God-worthy, and I think this, what we're doing, is God-worthy.
The Bay Ridge Methodists are no strangers to tough economic times. After giving up their former church, a historic building, because maintenance costs were too high, they now share space in a local Lutheran church's property. And they say that just looking around their neighborhood has been enough to make them seek serious answers to their economic concerns.
You see some stores that have been there for a long time that have closed down.
The rents are very high there. That's why a lot of people, even though they put in a lot of hours, they work hard, to meet the rent, it's very difficult.
And not just businesses, but ordinary families are also finding life hard.
The kid's getting out of college now. When I graduated college, I could have gotten a job anywhere, no matter what kind of degree you had. Now they have all this debt, and they're not getting the jobs.
Things are much harder now. They really are, relative to what they were when I was growing up, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. My husband and I, we make a pretty good living. We are not poor, but we really, truly live paycheck to paycheck.
It could prove a bold challenge to the economics community coming up with answers to satisfy this congregation.
For someone to be worthy of this award, it needs to be a Nobel quality or beyond.
One thing we should do is frame it as a message from
200 miles away in Boston, a group of economists has emerged who feel they are up to the Bay Ridge challenge. For 40 years now, they've been producing economics textbooks under the banner of Dollars and Cents, plus a magazine of the same name.
There are a lot of kind of smarty-pants economists out there who might be able to give their own theories, and they might be similar to ours, but our mission is to do it in an accessible way.
Applicants for the Bay Ridge Prize will likely focus on globalization as an explanation for today's tougher times and the need for changing skill sets among workers in a high-tech world. Dollars and Cents member Zoe Sherman wrote a cover story for the magazine's anniversary edition that directly addresses Bay Ridge's concerns that life seemed more prosperous 4 decades ago. She emphasizes that though many more people may be going to work these days, workers' income has not climbed along with that increase.
Our labor force participation is higher than it was 40 years ago. So on average, we are all putting in more hours of market work, but without necessarily proportionally more reward.
The Dollars and Cents Group reckons that structural shifts in the economy lie behind many people's smaller share in the nation's wealth.
If we add up a variety of different kinds of employment that are not very certain, what's sometimes called the gig economy, people doing freelance work, picking up odd jobs here and there, and the self-employed whose income can be quite variable and uncertain, that adds up to about 30% of the economy that does not have a predictable, regular paycheck.
While such analysis may ring true to some of the Bay Ridge congregation, many are wary that the submissions they get from economists will be ideologically partisan. In fact, their announcement insisted that they want a complete absence of ideology. How possible is that in such a contentious field?
I don't think anyone can submit a nonpartisan submission, and I don't even know what that would look like. I think the ideological lines are pretty sharply drawn now.
But co-editor Sturr believes they can avoid political partisanship.
We think that the Democrats and the Republicans are equally, at fault, or maybe not equally, but both heavily implicated in the policies that have led to our current economic predicament. And if ideology is kind of rigid thinking, we think that you need to be flexible in how you respond.
For Professor Sherman, the very act of applying for the award will help her group's overall aim to involve regular people more fully in economic issues.
The more people feel empowered to participate in the discussion of how our economic system should work and how they should be able to participate and what kinds of needs they need met by the economic system, the better we can do.
This approach echoes Pastor Emmerich's original intentions, and he even thinks it might help the church and its members towards achieving a better economic life for themselves by getting a fuller understanding of finance and of their choices as voters between different economic policies.
That's our goal, to empower the average person to be able to make decisions and make judgments that are going to affect their life very deeply, and the lives of their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
And for the congregants of Bay Ridge, it all fits with their desire as a community for a better life, materially as well as spiritually.
Economic well-being means people's well-being. It's my well-being, it's John's well-being, it's Susan's well-being and her children's well-being. And it makes sense, I think, for a church to say, let's come together and let's really try to think this out and think this through.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Terestrup in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, New York.
We have an interview now with the former chief rabbi of Great Britain, Jonathan Sacks. There's no one quite like him in the U.S. Sacks is a learned philosopher and Orthodox rabbi, the author of 25 books with 16 honorary degrees. He's a newspaper columnist and a popular broadcaster who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. He's also a member of the House of Lords. All that and a sense of humor as well.
The key voices at these moments have been the survivors.
Rabbi Sacks is teaching and lecturing in the U.S. this year. He was the keynote speaker at the Jewish Federation's annual General Assembly and then taught a class where he recalled his knighthood ceremony.
When you receive a knighthood, you have to kneel. And Jews don't kneel. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we do, but any other time, no. So they provide this little thing which you hold on to, this little rail, so that you can incline yourself a little without actually kneeling. At which point, as I'm sure you know, the Queen turned to Prince Philip and said, "Why is this knight different from all other knights?"
That's knight with a K. As Britain's chief rabbi for 22 years, Sacks got to know many of the world's leaders. He was widely respected and honored. And then he retired to lead a global religious response to global religious violence.
I'm afraid that religion causes violence whenever we confuse piety and power. Those are two completely different things. So when I seek power in the name of piety, I do great harm. I injure God's world. Fundamentalism, which is what we're talking about here in any religion, is always the product of fear. And I believe we have to allow faith to conquer fear. Somehow we have to let the better angels of our nature prevail over the fear that turns people into enemies. With religious movements, it's extremely hard to make peace because peace demands a virtue called compromise, which to a religious mind is not a virtue but a vice.
And learning to respect each other's religions, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, will take how long?
I set myself to kind of educate the educators of the next generation. And I don't think there's any shortcut. There's no quick fix here. You don't suddenly turn radicals into moderates. You have to educate a generation.
That means we're looking at these atrocities for, what, another generation or two?
I suspect so.
Sachs insists that his message applies not only to Jews, but to others as well.
I fight for the right of Christians to live their faith without fear anywhere in the world. But I need you Christians to fight for the right of Jews to live without fear anywhere in the world.
Sachs saw for himself the damage violent religious extremism can do when he visited Ground Zero in New York after 9/11.
Murder of the innocent is forbidden in Islam. Suicide is forbidden in Islam. To be a suicide bomber is categorically forbidden in Islamic law. So you have here some religious radicals who are doing in the name of Islam what the leading teachers of Islam now and throughout the Muslim past have ruled to be categorically forbidden.
Sachs's hope that education can prevent violence is challenged by the Nazi Holocaust, which was supported by many of Europe's most cultured and learned people.
The more you study the Holocaust, the less you understand. I've spent a lifetime studying it, and I still cannot understand. There were string quartets playing in Auschwitz-Birkenau while 1.25 million human beings were gassed, burned, and turned to ash. What happened in Auschwitz, in the Holocaust, was a terrible demonstration of the limits of civilization to civilize if we do not fear God and see his image in every human person.
Now the internet and social media are spreading anti-Semitism.
The end result is that hostility anywhere can be communicated everywhere. I wouldn't say it's people are suddenly starting to hate Jews. It's just that a few people have learned how you can communicate hate very effectively and very widely.
Is anything like that happening in the United States?
I can't see how the United States can remain immune to it. Nobody is immune to it.
Sachs has deep praise for the ability of the U.S. over its history to combine religion and freedom.
If you want proof that you can be deeply religious and yet create a society that respects the freedom of the other, then you have to look here in America.
Sachs calls this a historic moment, challenging religious leaders to prevent the violent misuse of their own and everyone else's faith.
I think when the world, in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, parts of Asia, are tearing themselves apart by people fighting wars of religion of a kind we haven't seen since the 17th century, to get up and say to be a Jew is to be true to your faith, and at the same time a blessing to others regardless of their faith. If people took that one sentence to heart, it would change the world.
Which is just what Rabbi Sacks, in so-called retirement, is trying to do. Next week, hear part two of my interview with Rabbi Sacks. Construction began this week on a new museum in Washington, D.C. that aims to promote appreciation of the Bible. The eight-story, 430,000-square-foot Museum of the Bible will be housed in a former refrigeration warehouse three blocks from the U.S. Capitol. It will focus on the history, narrative, and impact of the Bible and contain more than 44,000 rare Bible artifacts belonging to the Green family of Oklahoma, the museum's founders and owners of the Hobby Lobby chain. On our calendar, this coming week marks the new year, the year of the sheep, for the Chinese and many other Asian cultures. In the Tibetan tradition, the New Year's holiday is called Losar, and there are many rituals associated with it. Kim Lawton has more on how many Tibetans prepare themselves spiritually for the new year.
Losar is an important family time filled with ancient traditions. Celebrations actually begin on the 29th day of the 12th month of the Tibetan lunar calendar, the day before the last day of the old year. Families gather on this night for gutuk, a special noodle soup with at least 9 ingredients. In Queens, New York, Tibetan Buddhist Tenzin Gyatso says the soup is eaten as part of a ritual to welcome an auspicious new year.
My mom is making the offer of the dish we're going to have for tonight, praying for the long life and happiness and everything that we desire.
In the soup, each person receives a piece of dough with a special object hidden inside, such as chili, salt, butter, cheese, wood, a pea, or a pebble. These are believed to reveal a personality trait of the person receiving it.
My elder sister just got a piece of green chili, which symbolizes that she's not polite, rude, and everything.
This night is a time to get rid of the negative aspects of the past year. A small piece of dough called pachi is skimmed over the body, touching areas with pain or discomfort. Tibetans believe that circling the dough 3 times will transfer aches and ailments to the pachi. The pachi is then placed into a bowl, which also contains a hamachoma, a piece of dough in the shape of a woman. Family members will remove the hamachoma from the house.
The hamachoma is the one who's supposed to take all the bad happenings of the year with her. With the hamachoma, we'll have a little candle to show her the way. We don't want her to look back, come back. When we come back home, my mom, my sister-in-law, my sister, would ask us, oh, where are you guys coming from? We just say, oh, we came from really happy, a place with a lot of happiness, where we can have a lot of fun. Finally, they decided to let us in. They will have a black stone. We have a white stone. We exchange it. The white one will stay inside the house. The black one will stay outside of the house. Our balls are already filled in again, and we're going to have the last serving. We do it every year.
The Losar ritual, Gyatso says, helps make them spiritually clean for the new year.
All the bad things that happen during the year, any bad things in terms of luck, any accidents or any losses, any unfortunate things that happen that are undesirable, getting rid of them, throwing them away so that we can go to a new year with a fresh mind, no problems, and we can start over.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Also this week, many Christians around the world begin the observance of Lent, the season of preparation leading up to Easter. For Western Christians, Lent begins on Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, when they traditionally receive a mark of ashes as a symbol of penitence and a reminder of human mortality. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from Christian rapper Lecrae, who won a Grammy Award this week for Best Contemporary Christian Song Performance. The song is called Messengers.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.